There's a town near to where I grew up that when I was young, there was like kind of not going a lot, not a lot going on there. It was a little run down. Had seen its better days at that point, it thought, and you know, a few bars, a few pizza places, and we kind of never went there. And then sort of over time, sort of artists kind of started moving in, and these kind of, you know, funky little shops started opening. You know, it was all kind of boarded up storefronts before this, you know, and you know, there's like a vegetarian restaurant and little kind of these like you know, kind of artsy movie theaters, and so it had this sort of progression of kind of turning into this kind of very interesting kind of dynamic culture that was kind of getting created there over time. And and then there was sort of this other shift that started to happen eventually, where kind of some of the funkier places sort of disappeared, and there were kind of nicer shops, you know, like these boutiques and lots of restaurants and stuff from all around the world. And it was sort of had this sense of, you could tell this sort of sense of self-satisfaction as this like kind of liberal utopia. And, you know, just how cool everything was and how much they cared about everything. And at the same time as this was happening, there started to be more homeless folks who started showing up, panhandlers, spending kind of more time along the sidewalks and the streets. And it's, I don't know to what degree they were sort of like the displaced folks who could no longer afford to live in this town, or just, you know, people who had come upon hard times in the many ways that that can happen, and saw that there was wealth in this community being offered very generously in many ways. But over the years, it sort of started to kind of create a tension, not so much on the part of many of the panhandlers, but of the kind of business owners and the people who just liked their aesthetic and kind of the way things were, you know. And over the years, it's been really kind of gotten kind of more intense, some of the animosity. And so to make a long story short, or a long story a little longer, recently, I was sort of checking out kind of local news in that area, and saw that the mayor one night had decided to get the DPW to go around town and unbolt all of the benches across the whole town, because the business people were upset that there were panhandlers kind of hanging out on the benches all day and it was affecting their business. It's so awful. It's so intense, you know, and it's really, it affected me deeply when I, you know, when I first sort of heard this, of just the sadness and the sadness of it, of just like how hard it was for the sort of mainstream, the dominant forces in that culture to have a relationship with its margins, right? With the you know, the people that sort of made them feel uncomfortable, that might have mirrored something back to them that they didn't like, or what have you, you know, for the many reasons that there were enough people in this town that just wanted these people to go away. And so it's this weird, you know, this passive-aggressive way of doing it. You know, it's like, oh, just disappear the benches. Like, that's going to work, right? luckily, I actually checked out the news recently. Of course, many of the good people of that town are like furious and up in arms, and the city council is really upset. And you know, they're gonna put more benches. Imagine that! Like, it's genius, right? Yes, exactly. There should be enough room for everyone to sit. You know. And so I offer this little allegory as a warning for our own spiritual path. Because there's a lot of ways that our path can kind of be resonant with parts of the story of this town. You know, that we often will come to our spiritual practice, our spiritual life, in sort of some degree of rough shape, you know. And the sort of, kind of like the initial period of insight and excitement and energy and growth and development that can happen when we first start to practice is just, it can be so awesome and so inspiring and so beautiful, you know, and we can touch into an understanding of a beauty that exists, a goodness that exists that we weren't even aware of before, right? And that is wonderful, you know? It's designed that way, right? Like, we're supposed to be able to have these experiences that are supportive, right? That are bolstering, that are inspiring, that are moving, that help. The idea is that they help keep us going, right? They help keep us engaged in the practice. But what can happen is sometimes we can think that that's what it's about, right? That it's just about trying to kind of create and hold on to these beautiful states that we love so much, that are nourishing us, but that actually aren't the whole picture, right? And that we actually have a moral obligation to use the inspiration, to use the bolstered heart that we get from these practices, to also look at the parts of ourselves that are harder to be in relationship with. And I think it's really important to say, you know, that it's, sometimes we will give the message of like, you know, this Vipassana isn't just about feeling good, right? That's obvious at this point, right? But it's not like about feeling bad either, right? It's not like we're just trying to be in sort of, you know, despair all the time, just working with like the agonizing parts of our existence, you know? It's getting that there is this back and forth, that those parts of ourselves need to be in relationship with one another, that we need to be in relationship with all of it as healthy and with as much integrity and kindness and interest as we can. And I think that part of it can come from this fear that our goodness is threatened by our shadows, right? That we have a taste of some of our own goodness, and that if there then arises something that we don't feel as comfortable with, right? That we're not as proud of, that we're more ashamed of, that we don't have as easy a time appreciating, that we can feel like that is, it's going to threaten this goodness, this purity that we have kind of cultivated. And I just want to convey as strongly and as lovingly as possible that that's not true. That any goodness that can be threatened that easily by greed, hatred, delusion, it isn't ultimate goodness. Right, if it's that fragile, it's not that good. and when you look, you can see that it's not. That actually, all of these deep beautiful qualities of mind and heart that we do know are there at times. We lose faith, we lose sight of them at times, but we've all had experiences where we've seen those parts of ourselves. And then we've also seen, we've had enough experience seeing these other parts of ourselves, and it just takes the faith of having and the courage to have a relationship with them to start to see that not only do they not threaten it, right, but that actually the goodness that comes out of being able to go back and forth, the goodness, the beauty, the happiness that comes from being able to dip into all parts of who we are is a much stronger happiness. It's a much stronger peace. It's what we are aiming for is this happiness, this peace, a love, an ability to connect that is imperturbable, right? The fully enlightened mind cannot be shaken by whatever arises because it completely understands all phenomenon. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to develop a relationship with all phenomena, right, in our minds, our hearts, our bodies. The deepest periods of equanimity that we can have are untroubled by the arising of greed, hatred, anger, frustration. It's like when you're there and you see it and you see the nature of it, as you know Greg talked about some last night, of you know that all phenomena are impermanent, they're all undependable, they're all not of the nature to have a core self, right? When we really see these and we understand them, they're not a threat, you know, they're friends that we welcome. And so this is, you know, this is how it works. It's like we do need the goodness, right? We need to feel at times the calm, the concentration, the kindness, the happiness. Like it's good to actually be trying to cultivate those qualities because they do bolster the heart. They give the heart enough strength to be able to go into the harder places, right? That we actually need that protection of kindness in order to be able to have the courage to go into, you know, the undependability of things can be intense, to say the least, right? So the courage, the nest, the home of caring, of how hard it is actually to be in the world, how hard it is to see the pain, the suffering of ourselves, of others, of the constant flux of things, the undependability, right? We need that kindness. And then the wisdom, right? The truly seeing things as they are, the intention as we observe whatever we're observing, to really understand it, to really have a relationship with it, to explore it. It purifies the kindness. It purifies the love. Because it really, we start to distinguish between love that is attached to certain conditions that will, if certain things are present, then we can love them, right? If certain behaviors are okay, then love will be offered. Or if things are going okay, we can be kind, versus the unconditional love, right? The love that is possible beyond all of that. And just to go, you know, to that metaphor of the town just for a second, I don't want to overstate it, but you know, it's like we're both, you know, we are both of those parts of ourselves. And there's, you know, it isn't necessarily that one or the other is harder, right? Is our dominant part of ourselves the hardest part, or the marginal part's the hardest part? You know, for me, it's like when I read that thing, I was ready to go to the like edge of that town and just like put a curse on it, you know? And it's like, that's not nice. That's not the one love. And I see, it's like, okay, well, there's the part of myself that's the part of me that's hard to see, right? That's hard to connect with, that I don't appreciate, right? The part of myself that's dismissive, that doesn't want to deal with problems, the part of, you know, that it's like, that's actually maybe the harder part for me, is like that part of myself, right? So for all of us, it's like, we have to get that we have the oppressor, we have the oppressed, we have it all within us, and that actually it is all worthy of kindness, it is all worthy of investigation. A few weeks ago, I was at the ocean, and I noticed a really, really old man not too far away from me. He was in his shorts, you know, his swimming trunks. I live in Hawaii, and there, so he has like crazy Hawaiian board shorts, and he was just sort of sitting there on the beach in a chair, you know, and it was beautiful to just see how much he was appreciating just sitting there and being at the ocean, you know. And then he started to get up and walk toward the ocean. And he was old enough and frail enough that this, it was amazing, actually, you know, to see that he was trying to do this. And he had two canes, you know, these sort of sticks he was walking with. And his grandson came up next to him to kind of try to help him walk to the water. And it took forever. You know, he just was very slowly, you know, I mean, it's in the sand and the things are kind of getting stuck, and he's just very slowly, very carefully walking toward the water, and his grandson is kind of giving him the space, but, you know, trying to support him if he can. And finally he gets to the water, and kind of, you can see just the waves, just, and they're very small waves, but subtle ripples almost, just kind of lapping up on his feet. And I thought that was it, you know. I was like, wow, you know, well, beautiful, well done, or whatever, you know, stupid young guy. And he keeps going. And it was incredible to see these waves that I would not have even noticed, but that were enormous for him, right? That he had to brace himself so much for just these sort of ripples that would come in to the shore, and his grandson would kind of hold him, and you know, it took 10 minutes, you know, just for him to walk like a little bit away. He'd walk a little bit, and a wave would come, and he'd just kind of wait. And his grandson would be there, and sometimes like a little bigger wave would come, and they really would have to kind of hold on. And then finally, you know, they get to a certain point, and they're standing there, and he's sort of, you know, getting his balance, and slowly he hands his cane, one cane, to his grandson. He hands the other cane. He kind of holds on to him, and then in a moment, just slowly, just lets go into the water. And it was so beautiful, you know. So beautiful in so many ways, you know, that we never know when the last time we might go into the ocean is. And how much would you appreciate that, right? How much would you just relish that experience? But then this sort of beauty of this relationship between this grandfather and grandson, of just, it really affected me in that level of like, can we be that good companions to ourselves, right? To those parts of ourselves that are so fragile and that are wounded or that are exhausted or that are old. Those parts of ourselves that have a hard time with even the slightest ripple. Can we be that kind of companion to ourselves in our practice, in our lives? it was you know, it was beautiful because I had had years ago I'd had another experience of where I'd seen a father bringing his baby child into the ocean for the first time, and just that it was this very similar powerful experience of just how carefully they needed to kind of, you know, bring the baby in and pull it back when it would start to tremble and offer it and bring it back, and something very similar of that quality of how we need to, how we are called to take care of our own hearts. And we just, yeah, the particularly these marginalized places. You know, there's a man named George Lakey who's a great social justice organizer and activist in Philadelphia who really got a lot of good work and thinking done around this notion of margins and mainstreams. You know, that we, any group of people, any culture, and any individual has margins and mainstreams, right, as part of our identity. And that there are many qualities to this, but one of the particularly powerful ones that I think is relevant to us is just that the mainstream will ignore the margin as long as it can. And when it finally is put face to face with it, it will often consider it an obstacle. Right, it will think of the margin as an obstacle, as something that's in the way of getting where it wants to go. And yet, what the mainstream needs to grow is always at the margin. Right, that the group as a whole, neither part of things can move forward until that relationship starts to get built. And so that we have that. Within ourselves, you know, we all have these places that are calling for our attention and our kindness and our interest in this relationship. And the goodness that can come out of that endeavoring is the goodness of this practice. You know, and it can take a long time. The that 10 to 15 year, you know, thing that was said the other day, it's like, yeah, that's like pretty good, you know, 15 years. I was, and Deepak Chopra and Oprah had this like month-long 21-day meditation challenge or something. I was on the internet and I caught wind of it. So I kind of, you know, went and checked it out a little, and there was this great video of this young woman who had done it, you know, and she had never done this before. It was kind of her, you know, video blog, and she was just like, I'm, you know, transformed after this, you know, 20 days of, you know, meditating every day. And it was like, ah, that sounds great, you know. And just the, would that it were so... quick, you know, and of course, yeah, that's exact, you know, that is often, it's like we need to feel the accessibility of that, you know, of the accessibility of liberation. And then ultimately something else needs to start kind of motivating us over time. You know, it can't be that sense of kind of how quickly things move. The humility that's really needed for the pace of change that is just largely out of our control, you know. You just keep kind of showing up. There's a great story I read recently about a monk who was a great scholar. This is sometime after the time of the Buddha. He was one of these monks who had kind of memorized the entire canon, and he just knew everything. And it's said that he helped 10,000 people, 10,000 monks and nuns, and I don't know about lay people, become arahants, fully enlightened people. And yet he himself had not become enlightened. He had not attained that. He hadn't practiced, right? He had really spent his whole time memorizing these texts and being a scholar. And at one point, one of his students who had become fully enlightened realized this about his teacher, you know, and kind of nudged him that maybe he should try to do it, you know, try to practice. And it took a little while. And so finally he said, okay. And I'll go sit for the weekend, and that should be enough. You know, I know what I'm doing. If anyone knows what they're doing, I know what I'm doing. And so the weekend came and went, and he just hadn't gotten anywhere. And he said, well, the rains retreat is coming up soon, so I can, you know, I can sit for these 3 months, and I'll just do that. You know, I've got, it's all squared away, and I can make that happen. So 3 months come and go, and he just feels, like, more bewildered, you know, more lost and out of it. So he realizes he can just kind of keep going, and he might as well, you know, because he should do this. It's getting more clear that he actually needs to do this. And years go by. Years and years and years and years and years go by. And after 20 years, he went outside his kuti, and he just felt totally defeated. You know, just like, what am I doing? It's not working. I'm hopeless. This, you know, I've spent all this time doing it, and I just have no idea what I'm doing wrong, and I'm a hopeless case, you know. And so he just started sobbing and crying, you know, and really just getting in touch with that place that maybe you have, you know, of just how much we may long for freedom and sometimes how far away it feels. And there was a deva nearby, like a spirit being, a protective spirit being, and she saw him. And she said, well, maybe I can help, right? So she went a ways over into the forest a little bit, and she started crying, sobbing. And he noticed, right? He hears this, and he kind of is curious. And so he goes over into the forest, and he finds her there crying. And he said, what's wrong? And she's like, oh, nothing. I'm just trying to get enlightened. And he's like, you can't get enlightened crying about it. And she says, that's what you're doing. And he was like, oh, you're right. I'm just going to keep noting, you know? And it was that point of just being like, oh, just keep practicing. You know, it's just like we can start to feel like these, you know, we can get hit with these waves of like these parts of ourselves, right? And again, it's ourselves and the identification of it. It's not the best metaphor, but these phenomena, doubt, right? This, you know, the waves of doubt, right? Of our total inability to do this, or this being totally the wrong thing for us, you know? The power and the force of those things can be so overwhelming, you know? Sadness, anger, wanting. And yet, there are times where all we need to do is just note it. It's like, oh yeah, it's just wanting. It's just doubt. Rising, falling, pressure, lightness, motion, stillness, warmth, coolness. And that patience that we need with ourselves, you know, to be at this for the long haul. Just remember that that is an act of kindness, right? That patience with yourself is actually love. It's a form of love. That willingness to just abide with what is, right? With how long things are taking, how short things are taking, just that willingness to actually live at the pace of reality versus what we think should be happening. what we want to be happening. I wasn't going to tell the story, but we have time. We all help, four of us and others, a retreat in Burma each year at this monastery. And so there's the retreat that happens, and then there's also some kind of humanitarian work that we help with. And a piece of that is inviting acupuncturists to come and train Burmese doctors and acupuncturists in the method, so that they can kind of go and do work around the country. So we have our group of acupuncturists that we sort of have cultivated and invited. And last year there was another group of acupuncturists who came. And we had just gone to visit this monk who we often refer to him as the Happy Sayadaw. He's 98. He is super happy. He is clean. He's just like, I just give anything away, I don't want to have anything. And he gives us cookies, and he's all just like laughing, and he's different than a lot of the other Sayadaws that we meet in terms of how he holds the freedom that he's living with. So he, being around him, it's like you're just like in some nuclear reactor, you know, of just love and peace. And so we had just kind of come from our first visit to him, and you know, it's just like everything's groovy, and you can kind of ride his vibe for a little while. And as soon as we walk into the monastery, the guy who's running the acupuncture program was running at me, and he's like, "Jesse, help me!" I was like, "Okay, what's happening?" This other group of acupuncturists had showed up at the monastery, and they had paid to have this experience where they were going to volunteer at the clinic and help, and they're going to stay at the monastery and have this awesome experience. But there was no room at the monastery. We were full of yogis. And there had been some miscommunication around that. And their hosts had felt like, well, there's room at the hospital, there's room at the hotel, we'll put you guys up there. And they were not into it. They were like, we paid to be at the monastery, and we want to be at the monastery, and we're going to be at the monastery. And I was like, you are not going to be at the monastery. There's no room at the monastery. And no big deal, you know? Great, thanks for coming. You know, it's awesome to have you guys here. And it ended up turning into this like, very intense and heated exchange where it was deeply inappropriate to have this kind of argument at the next to Sayadaw's Kuti in the monastery, you know. And you could see that some of the folks who were just hanging out were kind of like, whoa, you know. Just like yelling at me and me being like, I don't know, sorry, you know. And I was just like, do you guys, you know, I'm like, we're here at a Buddhist monastery, you know. Like, there's what's happening, and there's what you want to be happening. And why are you committing to that? Right? Like, let's just go to this. Because we can work with this. And there's just nothing to be done there with what you want to be happening, you know? Oh, man. And it was awesome in that pure sense of going from this monk who was just like, was just so at peace. It just had no agenda with anything, you know? And then these folks who were just like wanted their monastery experience, you know. Oh. And then finally, Sayadaw wants to make everybody happen. He's trying to accommodate. We finally cleaned out two kutis that were old and decrepit, and they fixed them up, and so a couple people could stay there, you know. And then of course it was a disaster, you know. It's like we get up at 3:30 in the morning there, you know, and there's just like they don't want to get up at 3:30 in the morning, you know, and it's just loud by the kitchen, and you know, there's the food was crazy for them, and it was not the experience that they were aiming for, you know? And you could just, it was very powerful to see the, just how when we're so attached to how we think things should be going or how we want things to happen, and that we're so close to life and to the possibility of what could be happening, right? The possibility of the unknown experiences that we could be happening that we're missing because we're so fixed on what we think should be going on, you know? And so even, you know, it's like that. It's like that, just that sense of patience, you know, patience with ourselves. And it's not to say that we don't all have that in us, right? We all want things that bad, definitely, you know? And we have to actually have a relationship with that part of ourselves that understands, you know, that's kind. That's like, of course you want this to be happening. Of course, you know, whatever it is here on retreat, you know, that you just really wish was happening instead of what's really happening. You don't need to make fun of that part of yourself or, you know, denounce it or anything. It's just like it's totally understandable. We have ideas of what would be pleasant, and it's totally okay. But having the wherewithal to just see that it's just wanting. Have that patience with ourselves of like, oh yeah, there's still this wanting. It might feel like a very old wanting. It might feel like a very old frustration or anger, you know. It's this one of these things that we're still happening. Oh, this thing is still coming up. It's like, it's not, that isn't that kind of loving patience, you know, that restraint with judgment, right? The allowing of things to happen, allowing of it to play out, willing to have a relationship with it. And so there are actually a lot of examples of how this kind of love, loving kindness can play out as like restraint, right? So that there are all the kind of familiar acts of kindness and generosity that we can identify more easily and understand more easily. But there's something in particular on retreat that can be helpful of really attuning to the parts of our actions that are the renunciation that we take here. As an act of kindness, as an act of compassion and love for ourselves, for the others in this room, even for those back home. There's another great story of this monk who, this was during the time of the Buddha, supposedly, someone had offered him robes made out of lotus, a thread that can come out of a lotus flower, lotus blossom. Super fancy, right? Really super nice robes, right? You can imagine how many thousands of lotus flowers you'd have to like pull this one strand out, you know, in order to be able to weave a whole set of robes. And someone offered him these robes. It was a total honor, and he loved his robes. He was attached to his robes. He was so attached to his robes that when he died, suddenly, he was reborn as a flea on his robes. Poor guy. And then he had to go through this process of the robes then kind of getting folded up, and the other monks in the area were, you know, had to decide who was going to get his robes, you know. And he was, even as a flea, horrified that someone was going to give away his robes, you know, that one of these other monks was going to get his robes, you know. And so the Buddha, all-knowing as he was, could see that this little flea was so upset still about the fact that his robes were going to be given away, that he, if they gave the robes away, that this flea was gonna denounce a monk. And that is a really bad thing to do. And if he denounced this monk that received the robes as a thief, that the flea was gonna die and be reborn in a hell realm. And he also saw that the flea only had about a week to live. The lifespan of the flea was short. So he said, we're not giving away the robes right now. We're just going to wait. That's awesome. And so a week went by, the flea in constant anxiety. But he died without denouncing anybody and was reborn in the Deva realm, right? He got to go to a heaven realm. And then after he died, the Buddha said, okay, let's, you know, we can give the robes away to someone. And it's so, you know, it's such a great story of just that sense of how much actually an act of restraint, of like just patience, just waiting. We're actually going to wait on this sort of experience of generosity because we're so concerned about how someone's going to act based on their misunderstanding of it, that we're actually going to protect this being. We're going to protect this person from their own, you know, habitual actions, right, that would be destructive. It's so beautiful to see, to hold that possibility of restraint as an offering, right? Our own restraint as a deep protection for others. And so I just, you know, to offer, like, you all are here. Together, but you're all doing your own thing, right? You're giving each other space, and there can be times where it feels awkward or it feels hard, or you know you're trying to sort of cultivate these things, but you're not feeling like you have contact with one another, and that can feel like a limitation on your capacity to feel connected, you know. And then if we're trying to cultivate and honor this path of heart, of connection, of love, how do we do that in this sort of kind of more isolated way? And so just to offer that you are, that, you know, this, the precepts that you have taken, for example, amongst others, right? It's just like those are a deep offering to one another, right? It's a deep protection that you're offering of safety for one another to practice, of kindness, you know, the vow to not harm, to not take, to not bother anyone with, you know, sexual anything, you know. It's just like, great. It's just like, it's such an offering. The carefulness with our own mind, the carefulness with our actions. It can be helpful over, you know, as the retreat goes on, if it feels kind of dry or it feels isolating, or, you know, just, you can tune into that. You can tune into this sort of field of metta of kindness that you are creating with one another and for one another through this way. You know, it's even in Pali, the language of, you know, of the text, adosa, non-hatred, it's a synonym for loving kindness, right? It's not the sort of expansive version of it in terms of just like the side of the coin, but the non-hatred part is an offering, right? That willingness, that restraint is an offering of kindness and protection to one another. I like to think of my not cursing that town as an act of love. We all want to be free. And it's just really important to not, you know, throw parts of ourselves under the bus to get there, you know, to think that our freedom, our liberation, our happiness actually doesn't include a relationship with all of these phenomena, you know, with greed, hatred, and delusion as much as love and wisdom. and that you can start to appreciate this at a very subtle level, you know, as you deepen in this experience at the practice. You know, as I was saying a little earlier today, just noticing what is motivating the mindfulness. You know, what is motivating where you're bringing the attention in your practice? Because you can bring the mind, you can bring the attention towards something, and it can be coming from a very different place, and it has very different impact, very different meaning. If you are having some kind of unpleasant experience, you know, really notice what the quality is of the mindfulness that's brought there. And more than likely, we'll see that there are times, there's going to be moments where that is genuine interest, right? Where there's a sensation in the knee that's really painful, and that we go there and we're actually interested in it, right? That there's this kind of like, oh, what is this? What is this throbbing, stabbing, electric, pulsing, however you would, right? That kind of real curiosity. And then at times it'll go to like, if I pay close enough attention, it will go away, right? It will dissolve, it will disappear, it will dissipate. And when you even catch a glimmer of that thought, you have to just laugh a little, right? You have to smile at yourself for that, because it's definitely means that it's coming out of another place, right? It definitely is this part of ourselves that will try to bring attention to something to make it change into what we want it to be. And it's totally understandable, and it's totally not mindfulness, right? And so it's like seeing that, the willingness to see that. This is how the purification happens. It's one of the ways that the purification happens. It's like, oh, wow, wanting. Oh, aversion. Oh, I hate this, you know? Oh, I really want things to be this way. I really want this to go away. And being willing to see that, right? Never mind, just knowing, it's like, oh yeah, okay, this is mind, right? We bring the attention to the breath, to the, say, the breath at the abdomen. And we have an idea that over the course of the retreat, we will be able to follow it for longer, and we'll see it more clearly. Neither of those may be true, and that has nothing to do with whether your practice is deepening. Chances are, the more you look, the more you're going to see that you're not seeing the body at all. We have an impression of the abdomen in our mind, an image, a notion, a thought. We're mostly following that, not the actual direct physical experience. That's fascinating, right? That is incredible. When we realize how much we actually don't know what the body actually feels like, it shouldn't be despair creating. It should be incredible creating, right? I mean, it should be awe-inspiring of just being like, wow. Well, then, what does the body feel like? Where is the pressure? How quickly does one change from one to the next, right? What is the mind? Here's this thing that I thought was the body, and it's really mind. Oh, okay, well, what is the mind? Who is this being that is convinced it's there? You know, behind all of it, in the body, in the mind, somewhere. Check it out, right? That there's like this willingness to engage in that. Even when we see the parts of it that aren't willing to engage in it, it's like we can include everything. We can include the acceptance, we can include the resistance, we can include all parts of the process. Mahasi Sayadaw said this: don't be delighted with a pleasurable longing or desire. Don't get disappointed either. Anytime a desiring feeling occurs in respect to any pleasurable sensation, just carry on with your noting. Every time you anticipate and yearn for something, please note this mental act of yearning. Every time you feel disappointed, carry on noting the mind that is disappointed. It's so clean. It's so simple. And we can make it so much more complicated than that. You know, this, the act of companionship to ourselves, to the wounded parts, to the beautiful parts, to the beautiful wounded parts, right? Like all of this happening to our aversion, to the hatred, to greed, to kindness, towards sympathy. The companionship is, it doesn't have to be what we think of as like this deep experience, right? It's all happening so quickly. You can just note it. It's like, oh, you note an experience that's happening with kindness, with interest, and then you go note the next thing, right? We don't need to dig around into like what's happening to sort of get to the bottom of it, you know? The bottom of it is at the top of it. It's at the surface. We can learn all of these lessons. There is no bottom of it. There's only what's happening right now. There isn't anything behind what's happening. There's just what's happening. And you note it. And it's simple. And then you note the next thing. And you keep going. That quote of Mahasi's, it's like, you can just see it's the mind that he's talking about just isn't threatened by disappointment, right? It isn't threatened by wanting, by craving, right? Just note it. No big deal. Of course it's there. Note it. Know it's there. On to the next. I started very recently learning how to weave a traditional Hawaiian fiber. It's a kind of really through Polynesia, they use hala trees, the leaves, to make all kinds of everything, sails of canoes and mats and hats and baskets. And so I've at the, you know, super beginner level of just trying to learn a little. And so I went to this workshop where this elder was teaching us, and she showed us this sort of basic, very basic thing to learn how to do, and we did it, you know. And she said, listen, you know, everybody wants to do that thing and then go on to something next, right? Go on, okay, what's the next more complicated thing? What's the next more complicated thing? So that everyone wants to start making hats, you know, tomorrow. And it's like, you should see these hats, right? I mean, they're just gorgeous and impossible to imagine how you would do it. And she said, you know what? You do it. Do it again. You do the simple thing, you do it again. You do the simple thing, you do it again. All of everything you're going to need to know about the complex things are in that. Don't have this sense that it's like you need to get on to this next thing. It's a training. And that is what, you know, if we're doing anything, we're doing that, you know, because a lot of times we can get bored with the breath. We can think that the breath isn't really where the action is, you know, that there's all this like deep emotional stuff that we need to get to and kind of work out. And it's just there, that work may or may not happen, and there's value in that. But really remembering that the simplicity is also it's where it's at. With the breath, you can learn to relate to anything in the same way, because they all have the same nature. Anicca, dukkha, anatta, right? This impermanent, constantly changing, undependable, not core self. Like this is in everything that we will observe, that we have the capacity to observe, we can learn the same lessons. And that training of doing it with something that's neutral, doing it with something that's simple, doing it with something that's like imaginably manageable, right? We can imagine that we could actually be mindful of the breath. And then when something heavier comes along, right, when we do get these waves that come at times, you know, of incredible sorrow, you know, or incredible joy, overwhelming anything, you know, that we have actually developed the tools we need to be able to manage it, you know, to be able to actually handle it. And And then when we're overwhelmed, when it gets too much, what is the sort of kind companionship to ourselves? It's to move away. It's to know when we're outgunned, right? When it's like, this is actually more than we can handle. This is, then we're gonna pull back. We're gonna go to something neutral. We're gonna bring in something pleasant. We nourish the parts of ourselves that need the beauty, that need the goodness, so that next time it comes, we can kind of go back into it for a little longer, learn a little more, abide a little more fully. Because what I, offered this morning in the instructions about, a child's first breath, a baby's first breath, or a dying person's last breath, there really is something powerful at times to consider that in terms of how we're relating to anything. You know, if we're sitting here and a car goes by and that sound happens, how do we relate to it, And can we imagine if we were just had come into existence and these sounds were happening at the ear door, that there's the possibility we might actually be fascinated by that, right? That sound is actually bizarre and changing and wild and incredible. That we could have that freshness of interest in this thing that we pawn off as mundane. Or if we were dying and you knew that the last sound you were going to hear was this car driving by, something totally mundane, how would you hold it? How would you listen to it? How would you hope you would listen to it? Would you cling to it as like this, the last sound you're going to get? Or would you hope that you could just appreciate it and really receive it as the last sound you were going to hear? Last week, I got two text messages at the exact same time. It's never happened before. And I'm like, da-da-da-da. And so I looked at my phone, and the first one was my sister-in-law telling me that she was pregnant and that she and my brother were expecting a child. And the next one was a dear friend who told me her mother just died. And so there was this moment of just like, it stops the mind of having this like what appears to be these conflicting streams of life showing up at the same time, right? How do you respond? What is the reaction of the heart? And it was so powerful and beautiful and humbling to see that it was the same response, right? Love and understanding. It's actually the only appropriate response to anything. Caring, wisdom. And you can see that that's what this practice is cultivating in us, right? It's cultivating the ability to have that be more and more the natural response to everything. And that is really different than what we can sometimes imagine the enlightened mind as being just dull, right? This, we have this fear sometimes that like we're aiming towards just a non-reactivity towards all things, towards this sort of deadness of response. And just have as much faith in your own understanding, in your own experience, to know that that is not what we're headed towards, right? We're headed toward that capacity to meet every moment with kindness, with understanding. Whether it's something sad, something happy, something pleasant, something unpleasant. That's the heart and mind that we are building here together. Let's sit for a minute.